There's a big question here about how we write about the most important things in life, not just depression, but love and a sense of transcendence and the power of genuine, authentic human relationships. How do we write about that stuff?
This is The Labyrinth and the Thread, conversations about creativity and mental health for, by, and with people who love to create things and have experience navigating mental health. I'm Amelia Aldred, and I'm glad you're listening. Parker J. Palmer is founder and senior partner emeritus of the Center for Courage and Renewal. A writer, teacher, and activist, and former community organizer, his 10 books, which have sold 1.5 million copies and been translated into 12 languages, include The Courage to Teach, Let Your Life Speak, and Healing the Heart of Democracy. Parker, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Amelia. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, to start off, so that listeners have a sense of kind of where you're coming from, since medium can really influence how we think about creativity, what do you enjoy creating?
Great question. So starting with the fact that I'm a teacher and a writer, words are obviously a medium for me, a very important medium for me, probably life-saving medium for me. So I enjoy creating things with language. But I also, as the founder of the Center for Courage and Renewal, which has 300 facilitators around the world who create circles of trust for people to rejoin soul and role, as we say shorthand, I like creating spaces for people to enter in and weave their own tapestries, maybe stimulated by an idea or two that we may have, but bringing their own experience and language to the table. So I think it's the big tapestry, I guess, I've worked on for all my life as an activist and a writer and teacher, is some kind of weave of words and people and social spaces that have particular intent.
When you talk about weaving and weaving these different elements together, is there something that you find as a common thread?
Well, yes, there is. And again, it's a great question. It seems to me that the common thread that links words and spaces and people is the creative act that I try to engage in that allows people to find their own stories rather than simply listening to my story. That allows people to find their own thoughts rather than simply listening to my thoughts. The common thread is a desire to do, I'll put it this way in terms of writing, I always feel a need to do the work that only the writer can do so that the reader can do the work that only the reader can do. That's why I try to write clear, grounded, compelling prose so that the reader doesn't have to sit there saying, this kind of interests me, but I can't figure out what this guy is trying to say. That's work I should do ahead of time. And it's probably why it takes me 6 years and 15 drafts to write a book. And then if I do my job well, which sometimes do and sometimes don't, the reader can do the work that only the reader can do, which is to ask, okay, I see what's being said. The question then is, how does this connect with me? What does this evoke in me? So finding your own story, your own thoughts within the kinds of spaces I create, whether they're verbal or actually sitting, 25 people sitting in a circle, taking an inner journey in community, I think that's the red thread that connects things.
One of the things as we think about, again, kind of this interweaving, which is a beautiful image. I did take a weaving class once, and I remember I was taking it that I said a partway through to the instructor. I was like, this is like life, you know, it's all these different threads and you put it together. And she said, yes, Amelia, yes, as we were. I know that. There's been a few famous myths about that, maybe. I was like, oh, okay. Maybe they're not the first person who came up with this. But one of the things if you think about the different parts of our lives that interweave with each other and the way that our creative life ends up intersecting with other parts of our life, as we talk about mental health, how do you see that playing a role in this interweaving mm-hmm. of your life and of these different creative projects and expressions?
Well, Amelia, as I've said to you, one of the reasons I'm here with you right now is because I think this topic of mental health and creativity, or mental health and anything you want to link it with, is really critical. We need to be talking about these things openly to remove the shame factor and all of the stuff that gets in the way of us being present in healing and helpful ways to each other, right? That's one of the kinds of spaces that I love to create. And the reason I love to create those spaces and that I think it's important to talk about it is very simple. I have struggled in my life with a mental illness called clinical depression. I think it's very important to say up front, on this kind of topic, one size does not fit all. My story is my story. What comes out of it is not necessarily a prescription for other people, because depression is a mental health issue about which way too little is known. There's a lot of mystery about it. What has helped me along may not help someone else along. So with that disclaimer, I would say that my experience of clinical depression has been episodic, but the three profound episodes I've had in my life, two in my 40s and one in my 60s, were very deep, very dark, lasted for months at a time. I needed to get on medications to stabilize myself during those periods. I'm fortunate that I was able to get off medications after a while. I needed therapy in each situation. And I've engaged in ongoing therapy periodically, episodically, since then, whenever I feel kind of warning signs coming on. So in a culture that values always going up, 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 where down, down, down is failure and shameful, I've gone down, down, down a number of times. I've spent long months, probably, you know, easily 2 years total in my life, of waking up and wondering, or not going to sleep and wondering, is this the day that life just becomes insufferable and death would be preferable? And there's a lot to unpack there. But the point I want to make is that while I would not wish such an experience, obviously, on anyone, nor would I ever want to go there again, those experiences have been for me a kind of school of the spirit. They weren't a school of the spirit at the time they happened. Everything was dead, dead, dead. Somebody asked me once, you know, was God helpful to you during your depression? And I said, God was dead for me during my depression. So I have no theological language to wrap around that one, except God was dead. So was I, you know, death in life. But in retrospect, as one watches, is able to watch oneself going in and then watch oneself coming out, there's a great deal to be learned. And it would take, you know, many, many, many hours for us to all unpack all that learning. But here's one simple thing that occurs to me just as we're talking that I learned. I learned that when you have walked through a deep darkness like that and emerged on the other side, not only surviving, but thriving in the wake of it, nothing that you're asked to do is ever daunting again.
Everyone I've talked to who has emerged from depression or similar periods of suffering has a different story. But there is one theme that comes up again and again. How do you put something that is so difficult to conceive of into words? For many people, myself included, the challenge of doing that changed how we approached creative work. I asked Parker if that was the case for him as well.
Yeah, absolutely. An important observation. So I'll say two things about that. You know, one is that I'm a natural writer. I started writing when I was in my early 20s. I haven't stopped. Written a lot. Didn't publish anything until I was 40, and then only in a little, you know, offbeat journal or at a little offbeat press. And yet, my experience, my first experience with depression, doubled down on my commitment to writing, because I realized writing is a form of processing what's going on in my life in a way that helps me understand what's going on in my life. And in that sense, it helps me get ahead of the train wreck. So the writing is not like something that, oh, okay, now that I'm not depressed, I'll write because I'm in a space where I can do that. No, the depression loops into the creative act called writing for me, because for me, writing has nothing to do with getting a bunch of clear ideas and then just downloading it to the page, right? Which I think is a mistake some people make when they think about writing. I sit down to write not knowing what I'm going to write, or not knowing really what's happening. The other thing I want to say is that I think your question about mental illness being a really hard experience to describe could be enlarged into a question of that might go like this: how do we write about the mysteries in life? And I think life is about, you know, 85% mystery, and the rest is what's 2 + 2. And so there's a big question here about how we write about the most important things in life, not just depression, but love and joy and a sense of transcendence. The power of genuine, authentic human relationships. How do we write about that stuff? You know, nobody can write a formula for it. Only fools try, and frankly, only fools want one. So I ran across years ago a statement in a poem by Emily Dickinson, in which she has this very simple line that has never left me: tell the truth, but tell it slant. Tell the truth, but tell it slant. That the indirection of a poet or a good novel has intent, and it has a source, which is the artist can't say directly what he or she is trying to say because there's too much mystery in it, but not wanting to let mystery go unacknowledged or, you know, in some sense unnamed, the artist tells about it on the slant. And I love that notion. And so when I talk about my depression, I'll do a quick version of this. I often tell the story about how my body was dead during this particular depression that lasted for 9 or 10 months. But every afternoon about 4 o'clock, having asked my permission to do so, an older man whom I knew and trusted came over. I would seat myself in an easy chair in the living room. He would kind of kneel down in front of me, take off my shoes and socks, and massage my feet. He very rarely said a word. He was a very intuitive guy. And he somehow magically, intuitively found the only place in my body where I could feel a connection to other people. Because part of clinical depression is you feel utterly isolated. You are I used to say you're lost in the darkness. No, you've become the darkness. And there's no one else there. But he found a place in my dead body and emotions where I could feel that connection. He did it for half an hour, did it regularly. If he couldn't make it, he would let me know. But he was so faithful to that, and it was life-saving. So there's a story that tells the truth, but tells it slant.
One of my favorite questions to ask people is, what is some of both the best advice that they've received, and what is some of the worst advice they've received, or both, or neutral advice? But I'm just always really curious about what people have received when they think about creativity and mental health, because I find that we often have a very narrow set of stories about it and a very kind of narrow set of advice about that. And so I'm just really curious what other people's experiences have been there. Has there been anything that stood out?
You say, first of all, that as a writer, one of the earliest pieces of advice I got is one that a lot of young writers get, which is write about what you know. And it took me a few years to free myself from that and then to make a discovery that's mine, maybe in mine alone, although maybe some others would say this about themselves. I was born baffled. And that I came out, you know, and the doctor held me up and slapped me and I screamed. And part of that scream was, what's this all about? You know, what, this crazy world that I'm now.
Things were going so well. I was warm, I was happy. And then what is this nonsense?
Exactly. Fed 24/7, you know, with a kind of IV arrangement. And now I'm out here and have to fend for myself. I'm baffled. What is this all about? And I have remained baffled my whole life. And so I write about what I don't know, because especially when I find something that I don't understand, but I care about and I want to understand it more deeply. So that's a just quickie on that. You know, I think the narrative about mental illness for people like me, and I'm now talking about a white, straight, relatively well-off, now 81-year-old person who got a PhD and set out to pursue what turned out to be a strange, twisty, windy career, and it baffled other people. But the narrative for people like me is, if you want to be a success in your chosen field, never admit to mental illness. And a lot of people like me have absorbed that message, sadly. There's a really fine book on male depression with the perfect title. I Don't Want to Talk About It is the title of the book. And that's a classic expression from men who just don't want to talk about it, because this narrative of mental health being a shame and a disgrace and a career-ending failure has been so drilled into them that they don't know how to break out. They feel like they don't have the courage to break out. And so that they live a confined life, I'm afraid, sometimes for a lifetime. You know, I'm old enough to remember when a man named Thomas Eagleton ran on the Democratic ticket for vice president. I think it was with Gene McCarthy. And when it was discovered that he had spent time in a mental hospital for depression, he had to withdraw because, you know, all the big shots said, well, in this country, you will never get elected to high office because you are now deemed untrustworthy, right? And so this is tragic that, you know, good people are taken out of the action by this. And I think I labored with that for a while, and it actually took me 10 years after my first depression in my early 40s before I could write and speak about this. But the reason for me was not so much the pressure of that narrative. It was instead an instinct that I think turned out to be right, that before I write and speak about it, I should be sure that it's so fully integrated into my sense of self that I won't appear before a class or a retreat or before a reader as a guy who's kind of out of control and who needs to be taken care of. But rather, I have to hold this experience in a way that that offers a possibility of me taking care of others by saying, it's all right. You know, there is life on the other side. And if you're accompanying a person in depression, here's some stories about what helped me. You know, massage their feet if you feel drawn to do that, for example. There's another narrative, of course, about mental illness and creativity, which is you have to be mentally ill to be creative. You know, that also is horse hockey. You need that phrase a lot in this dialogue with the culture about mental illness. So I offer it up for whatever use it may be to other people. The whole question of narratives is very, very, very interesting and very, very important. I don't believe that you have to be mentally ill to be creative. That's nonsense. And I don't believe that you shouldn't talk about it. I believe indeed you should.
Parker was born baffled, and I was born curious. According to my mother, when I was born, I didn't cry. I just looked and looked around the room like I was taking field notes on this strange new world. One of the reasons I like to talk to people about mental health is that I'm curious about what new world we're building. I believe that we're slowly letting go of one set of narratives about mental health, but we don't know what the new narratives are. Parker and I talked about this process of rewriting our old scripts. If we don't believe that a bout of depression should be a career-ending event, then what do we believe? If how to write about depression is part of the larger question of how to write about the mysteries of life, then how to treat ourselves and others who experience depression is part of the larger question, how do we care for one another?
I'll give you a quick response to that very important question you just asked. What's the new narrative, you know, about caring for each other? And of course, the work you're doing with this podcast will help weave a new narrative. But here's the thread that I would put in. I very much think about caring for people with mental illness, and in my case, with clinical depression, as being akin to sitting at the bedside of a dying person. Because in that extreme moment, a moment many people have experienced, you are stripped of the illusion that you can be a problem solver in this situation. And if you ask people who've been there what they were doing, they only say some version of, I was bearing witness, or I was practicing presence, or I was being as fully present to the person as I knew how. I knew that I didn't have a fix or a save or advice. What I hope is that I was sitting there in a way that expressed my confidence that this person had the inner resources to make the final journey that can only be made alone by any of us. It doesn't matter really who's sitting at the bedside. If you're the dying person, you're dying. And you have to draw on your own resources to make that journey. And the presence of another person can, I believe, express confidence in the fact that you have that capacity, as the fellow who rubbed my feet expressed confidence in me. He didn't say, here's how to get well, or you seem to be on the edge of something really dark and dangerous. He never said that. He just practiced presence. Whereas many other friends engaged in what I call drive-by helping, in and out with a quick word of advice, which actually left me more depressed because they treated me as if this were a contagious disease. And there was some distrust of me and of the whole situation in that kind of drive-by, I care for you, bye, situation, as if I were contagious. So the yearning of people around the globe is to be witnessed, to for someone to notice, for someone to sit with, for someone to care in a way that is simply about seeing, witnessing, being present to. And as I like to say, we're all dying all the way anytime. You know, we're all dying all the time anyway. So why do we wait till the very end to practice that kind of presence? There are these moments in life that can fairly be described as death in life. Let's sit with each other in the same way we would want to sit on the literal deathbed, at the literal deathbed. Neither invading nor evading, but simply practicing presence.
Thank you. I think that is something we can all bear in mind at all times, I think especially right now, as people are trying to find ways to care for each other and care for each other under some really difficult circumstances. Well, as you said, we are coming to an end. This has been a wonderful conversation. I am so glad that you took the time to talk to me about this. I always like to end with asking folks if there's any particular projects that they're excited about right now, whether their own or other people's, or you know, things that they would particularly recommend.
Well, I'm happy to answer that. But before I do, let me just say this conversation has been a privilege for me, Amelia. I think you're opening a very important conversation here, and I'm very grateful to have had a chance to participate in it. Look forward to more of it on the podcast with other folks. So as it happens, as you know, the creative work that I'm doing right now involves your mother, which is a very happy situation for me. Carrie Newcomer, my friend and colleague, Carrie and I have created a project several years ago called The Growing Edge. And so you can Google The Growing Edge or newcomerpalmer.com, N-E-W-C-O-M-E-R, palmer.com, and get directly to our offerings there. And among other things, we offer a podcast and when we're able, retreats and a monthly newsletter and Carrie's music, and even a song that she helped me write is up there. And so it's been a very creative endeavor for me in starting in my mid-70s and going on now into my early 80s, a real joy to work with this very gifted singer-songwriter who is Amelia Aldred's mother. And you know, for me, it's a really interesting model of creativity because both of us are reaching across disciplinary lines. And so it's certainly stretched me. She might even say it stretched her. It's just, for me, creativity of the sort that at my age, I feel very lucky to be engaged in a real growing edge for me. That's a product placement reference.
Well, thank you. It is a wonderful podcast and a wonderful project. Having been privileged enough to get to witness some of it, I will say as a ringing endorsement that I always tell people that some of the most important things I know about being an artist and being an artist in community, I learned from my mother. Yeah. And I feel incredibly fortunate for that. I'm so happy just to see this project with the two of you. It's really wonderful. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support us, consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/labthreadpodcast. If you're not in a position to financially support us, you can help out by spreading the word and following us on social media. Stories, concerns, and manifestos can all be emailed to labthreadpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. Remember to take care of yourselves and each other. And until next time, from Chicago, Illinois, this is The Labyrinth and the Thread.